Side 11. Chapter 23. Gombauld was by no means so furious at their apparition as Dennis had hoped, and expected he would be. Indeed, he was rather pleased than annoyed when the two faces, one brown and pointed, the other round and pale, appeared in the frame of the open door. The energy born of his restless irritation was dying within him, returning to its emotional elements. A moment more, and he would have been losing his temper again, and Anne would be keeping hers infuriatingly. Yes, he was positively glad to see them.
"Come in, come in," he called out hospitably.
Followed by Mr. Scogan, Dennis climbed the little ladder and stepped over the threshold. He looked suspiciously from Gombauld to his sitter, and could learn nothing from the expression of their faces except that they both seemed pleased to see the visitors. Were they really glad? Or were they cunningly simulating gladness? He wondered. Mr. Scogan, meanwhile, was looking at the portrait.
"Excellent," he said approvingly. "Excellent! Almost too true to character, if that is possible. Yes, positively too true. But I'm surprised to find you putting in all this psychology business."
He pointed to the face, and with his extended finger followed the slack curves of the painted figure.
"I thought you were one of the fellows who went in exclusively for balanced masses and impinging planes."
Gombauld laughed.
"This is a little infidelity," he said.
"I'm sorry," said Mr. Scogan. "I, for one, without ever having had the slightest appreciation of painting, have always taken particular pleasure in cubismus. I like to see pictures from which nature has been completely banished, pictures which are exclusively the product of the human mind. They give me the same pleasure as I derive from a good piece of reasoning or a mathematical problem or an achievement of engineering. Nature, or anything that reminds me of nature, disturbs me. It is too large, too complicated, above all, too utterly pointless and incomprehensible. I am at home with the works of man, if I choose to set my mind to it. I can understand anything that any man has made or thought. That is why I always travel by tube, never by bus if I can possibly help it. For travelling by bus, one can't avoid seeing, even in London, a few stray works of God. The sky, for example, an occasional tree, the flowers in the window boxes. But travel by tube and you see nothing but the works of man. Iron riveted into geometrical forms, straight lines of concrete, patterned expanses of tiles. All is human and the product of friendly and comprehensible minds. All philosophies and all religions, what are they but spiritual tubes bored through the universe? Through these narrow tunnels, where all is recognizably human, one travels comfortable and secure, contriving to forget that all round and below, and above them, stretches the blind mass of earth, endless and unexplored. Yes, give me the tube and cubismus every time. Give me ideas so snug and neat and simple and well made. And preserve me from nature, preserve me from all that's inhumanly large and complicated and obscure. I haven't the courage, and above all, I haven't the time to start wandering in that labyrinth."
While Mr. Scogan was discoursing, Dennis had crossed over to the farther side of the little square chamber where Anne was sitting, still in her graceful lazy pose on the low chair. "Well?" he demanded, looking at her almost fiercely. What was he asking of her? He hardly knew himself. Anne looked up at him, and for answer echoed his "Well?" in another, a laughing key. Dennis had nothing more at the moment to say. Two or three canvases stood in the corner behind Anne's chair, their faces turned to the wall. He pulled them out and began to look at the paintings.
"May I see too?" Anne requested.
He stood them in a row against the wall. Anne had to turn round in her chair to look at them. There was the big canvas of the man fallen from the horse, there was a painting of flowers, there was a small landscape. His hands on the back of the chair, Dennis leaned over her. From behind the easel at the other side of the room, Mr. Scogan was talking away. For a long time they looked at the pictures, saying nothing, or rather Anne looked at the pictures, while Dennis, for the most part, looked at Anne.
"I like the man and the horse, don't you?" she said at last, looking up with an inquiring smile.
Dennis nodded, and then in a queer, strangled voice, As though it had cost him a great effort to utter the words, he said,
I love you.
It was a remark which Anne had heard a good many times before, and mostly heard with equanimity. But on this occasion, perhaps because they'd come so unexpectedly, perhaps for some other reason, the words provoked in her a certain surprised commotion. My poor Dennis, she managed to say with a laugh. But she was blushing as she spoke. Chapter 24. It was noon. Dennis, descending from his chamber, where he had been making an unsuccessful effort to write something about nothing in particular, found the drawing-room deserted. He was about to go out into the garden, when his eye fell on a familiar but mysterious object. The large red notebook in which he had so often seen Jenny quietly and busily scribbling. She had left it lying on the window-seat. The temptation was great. He picked up the book and slipped off the elastic band that kept it discreetly closed. Private, not to be opened, was written in capital letters on the cover. He raised his eyebrows. It was the sort of thing one wrote in one's Latin grammar while one was still at one's preparatory school. Black is the raven, black is the rook, but blacker the thief who steals this book. It was curiously childish, he thought, and he smiled to himself. He opened the book. What he saw made him wince as though he had been struck. Dennis was his own severest critic, so at least he'd always believed. He liked to think of himself as a merciless vivisector, probing into the palpitating entrails of his own soul. He was brown dog to himself. His weaknesses, his absurdities, no one knew them better than he did. Indeed, in a vague way, he imagined that nobody beside himself was aware of them at all. It seemed somehow inconceivable that he should appear to other people as they appeared to him. Inconceivable that they ever spoke of him among themselves in that same freely critical and, to be quite honest, mildly malicious tone in which he was accustomed to talk of them. In his own eyes, he had defects, but to see them was a privilege reserved to him alone. For the rest of the world, he was surely an image of flawless crystal. It was almost axiomatic. On opening the red notebook, that crystal image of himself crashed to the ground and was irreparably shattered. He was not his own severest critic, after all. The discovery was a painful one. The fruit of Jenny's unobtrusive scribbling lay before him. A caricature of himself, reading, the book was upside down. In the background, a dancing couple, recognizable as Gombauld and Anne. Beneath, the legend, Fable of the Wallflower and the Sour Grapes. Fascinated and horrified, Dennis pored over the drawing. It was masterful. A mute, inglorious rouvert appeared in every one of those cruelly clear lines. The expression of the face, an assumed aloofness and superiority tempered by a feeble envy. The attitude of the body and limbs, an attitude of studious and scholarly dignity, given away by the fidgety pose of the turned-in feet. These things were terrible, and more terrible still was the likeness, was the magisterial certainty with which his physical peculiarities were all recorded and subtly exaggerated. Dennis looked deeper into the book. There were caricatures of other people, of Priscilla and Mr. Barbecue Smith, of Henry Wimbush, of Anne and Gombauld, of Mr. Scogan, whom Jenny had represented in a light that was more than slightly sinister, that was indeed diabolic, of Mary and Ivor. He scarcely glanced at them. A fearful desire to know the worst about himself possessed him. He turned over the leaves, lingering at nothing that was not his own image. 7 full pages were devoted to him. Private, not to be opened. He had disobeyed the injunction. He had only got what he deserved. Thoughtfully he closed the book and slid the rubber band once more into its place. Sadder and wiser, he went out onto the terrace. And so this, he reflected, this was how Jenny employed the leisure hours in her ivory tower apart. And he had thought her a simple-minded, uncritical creature. It was he, it seemed, who was the fool. He felt no resentment towards Jenny. No, the distressing thing wasn't Jenny herself. It was what she and the phenomenon of her red book represented, what they stood for and concretely symbolized. They represented all the vast conscious world of men outside himself. They symbolized something that in his studious solitariness he was apt not to believe in. He could stand at Piccadilly Circus, could watch the crowd shuffle past, and still imagine himself the one fully conscious, intelligent, individual being among all those thousands. It seemed somehow impossible that other people should be in their way as elaborate and complete as he and his. Impossible! And yet, periodically, he would make some painful discovery about the external world and the horrible reality of its consciousness and its intelligence. The red notebook was one of these discoveries, a footprint in the sand. It put beyond a doubt the fact that the outer world really existed. Sitting on the balustrade of the terrace, he ruminated this unpleasant truth for some time. Still chewing on it, he strolled pensively down towards the swimming pool. A peacock and his hen trailed their shabby finery across the turf of the lower lawn, odious birds. Their necks, thick and greedily fleshy at the roots, tapered up to the cruel inanity of their brainless heads, their flat eyes and piercing beaks. The fabulists were right, he reflected, when they took beasts to illustrate their tractates of human morality. Animals resemble men with all the truthfulness of a caricature. Oh, the red notebook! He threw a piece of stick at the slowly pacing birds. They rushed towards it, thinking it was something to eat. He walked on. The profound shade of a giant ilex tree engulfed him. Like a great wooden octopus, it spread its long arms abroad. Under the spreading ilex tree... He tried to remember who the poem was by, but couldn't. The smith, a brawny man, is he, with arms like rubber bands. Just like his, he would have to try and do his Müller exercises more regularly. He emerged once more into the sunshine. The pool lay before him, reflecting in its bronze mirror the blue and various green of the summer day. Looking at it, he thought of Anne's bare arms and Seal's sleek bathing dress, her moving knees and feet. And little Luce with the white legs and bouncing Barbary. Oh, these rags and tags of other people's making! Would he ever be able to call his brain his own? Was there indeed anything in it that was truly his own, or was it simply an education? He walked slowly round the water's edge. In an embayed recess among the surrounding yew trees, leaning her back against the pedestal of a pleasantly comic version of the Medici Venus, executed by some nameless mason of the Seicento, he saw Mary pensively sitting.
Hello,
he said. For he was passing so close to her that he had to say something. Mary looked up.
Hello,
she answered in a melancholy, uninterested tone. In this alcove, hewed out of the dark trees, the atmosphere seemed to Dennis agreeably elegiac. He sat down beside her under the shadow of the pubic goddess. There was a prolonged silence. At breakfast that morning, Mary had found on her plate a picture postcard of Gobley Great Park, a stately Georgian pile with a facade 16 windows wide, parterres in the foreground, huge smooth lawns receding out of the picture to right and left. 10 years more of the hard times, and Gobley, with all its peers, will be deserted and decaying. 50 years, and the countryside will know the old landmarks no more. They will have vanished as the monasteries vanished before them. At the moment, however, Mary's mind was not moved by these considerations. On the back of the postcard, next to the address, was written in Ivor's bold large hand a single quatrain. Hail, maid of moonlight, bride of the sun, farewell. Like bright plumes molted in an angel's flight, there sleep within my heart's most mystic cell memories of morning, memories of the night. There followed a postscript of 3 lines.
Would you mind asking one of my housemaids to forward the packet of safety razor blades? I left in the drawer of my washstand. Thanks, Ivor.
Seated under the Venus's immemorial gesture, Mary considered life and love. The abolition of her repressions, so far from bringing the expected peace of mind, had brought nothing but disquiet. A new and hitherto unexperienced misery.
Ivor, Ivor!
She couldn't do without him now. It was evident, on the other hand, from the poem on the back of the picture postcard, that Ivor could very well do without her.
He was at Gobley now.
So was Zenobia. Mary knew Zenobia. She thought of the last verse of the song he had sung that night in the garden. Le lendemain, Félix Pesage aurait donné mouton et chien pour un baiser que le volage à Lisette donnait pour rien. Mary shed tears at the memory. She had never been so unhappy in all her life before. It was Dennis who first broke the silence. The individual, he began in a soft and sadly philosophical tone, is not a self-supporting universe. There are times when he comes into contact with other individuals, when he's forced to take cognizance of the existence of other universes beside himself. He had contrived this highly abstract generalization as a preliminary to a personal confidence. It was the first gambit in a conversation that was to lead up to Jenny's caricatures. True, said Mary, and generalizing for herself, she added, when one individual comes into intimate contact with another, she, or he, of course, as the case may be, must almost inevitably receive or inflict suffering.
One is apt, Dennis went on, to be so spellbound by the spectacle of one's own personality that one forgets that the spectacle presents itself to other people as well as to oneself.
Mary was not listening. The difficulty, she said, makes itself acutely felt in matters of sex. If one individual seeks intimate contact with another individual in the natural way, she is certain to receive or inflict suffering. If, on the other hand, she avoids contact, she risks the equally grave sufferings that follow on unnatural repressions. As you see, it's a dilemma.
When I think of my own case, said Dennis, making a more decided move in the desired direction, I am amazed how ignorant I am of other people's mentality in general, and, above all, and in particular, of their opinions about myself. Our minds are sealed books, only occasionally opened to the outside world.
He made a gesture that was faintly suggestive of the drawing off of a rubber band. It's an awful problem, said Mary thoughtfully. One has to have had personal experience to realize quite how awful it is.
Exactly, Dennis nodded. One has to have had first-hand experience.
He leaned towards her and slightly lowered his voice.
This very morning, for example,
he began, but his confidences were cut short. The deep voice of the gong, tempered by distance to a pleasant booming, floated down from the house. It was lunchtime. Mechanically, Mary rose to her feet, and Dennis, a little hurt that she should exhibit such a desperate anxiety for her food, and so slight an interest in his spiritual experiences, followed her. They made their way up to the house without speaking.
Chapter 25. I hope you all realize, said Henry Wimbush during dinner, that next Monday is bank holiday, and that you will all be expected to help in the fair.
Heavens, cried Anne. The fair, I had forgotten all about it. What a nightmare. Couldn't you put a stop to it, Uncle Henry?
Mr. Wimbush sighed and shook his head.
Alas, he said, I fear I cannot. I should have liked to have put an end to it years ago, but the claims of charity are strong.
It's not charity we want, Anne murmured rebelliously. It's justice.
Besides, Mr. Wimbush went on, the fair has become an institution. Let me see, it must be 22 years since we started it. It was a modest affair then. Now, he made a sweeping movement with his hand, and was silent.
It spoke highly for Mr. Wimbush's public spirit that he still continued to tolerate the fair. Beginning as a sort of glorified church bazaar, Crome's yearly charity fair had grown into a noisy thing of merry-go-rounds, coconut shies, and miscellaneous sideshows, a real genuine fair on the grand scale. It was the local St. Bartholomew, and the people of all the neighbouring villages, with even a contingent from the county town, flocked into the park for their bank holiday amusement. The local hospital profited handsomely, and it was this fact alone which prevented Mr. Wimbush, to whom the fair was a cause of recurrent and never-diminishing agony, from putting a stop to the nuisance which yearly desecrated his park and garden.
I've made all the arrangements already, Henry Wimbush went on. Some of the larger marquees will be put up tomorrow. The swings and the merry-go-round arrive on Sunday. So there's no escape, said Anne, turning to the rest of the party. You'll all have to do something. As a special favour, you're allowed to choose your slavery. My job is the tea tent, as usual. Aunt Priscilla?
My dear, said Mrs. Wimbush, interrupting her, I have more important things to think about than the fair, but you need have no doubt that I shall do my best when Monday comes to encourage the villagers.
That's splendid, said Anne. Aunt Priscilla will encourage the villagers. And what will you do, Mary?
I won't do anything when I have to stand by and watch other people eat.
Then you'll look after the children's sports.
All right, Mary agreed. I'll look after the children's sports.
And Mr. Scogan? Mr. Scogan reflected.
May I be allowed to tell fortunes? He asked at last. I think I should be good at telling fortunes.
But you can't tell fortunes in that costume.
Can't I?
Mr. Scogan surveyed himself. You'll have to be dressed up. Do you still persist?
I'm ready to suffer all indignities.
Good, said Anne, and turning to Gombauld, you must be our lightning artist, she said. Your portrait for a shilling in 5 minutes.
It's a pity I'm not either, said Gombauld with a laugh. I could throw in a picture of their auras for an extra sixpence.
Mary flushed.
Nothing is to be gained, she said severely, by speaking with levity of serious subjects.
And what about Dennis? Dennis made a deprecating gesture.
I have no accomplishments, he said. I'll just be one of those men who wear a thing in their buttonholes and go about telling people which is the way to tea and not to walk on the grass.
No, no, said Anne, that won't do. You must do something more than that.
But what? All the good jobs are taken, and I can do nothing but lisp in numbers.
Well, then, you must lisp, concluded Anne. You must write a poem for the occasion, an ode on bank holiday. We'll print it on Uncle Henry's press and sell it at tuppence a copy.
Sixpence, Dennis protested. It'll be worth sixpence.
Anne shook her head. Tuppence, she repeated firmly. Nobody will pay more than tuppence.
And now there's Jenny, said Mr. Wimbush. Jenny, he said, raising his voice, what will you do?
Dennis thought of suggesting that she might draw caricatures at sixpence and execution, but decided it would be wiser to go on feigning ignorance of her talent. His mind reverted to the red notebook. Could it really be true that he looked like that?
What will I do?
Jenny echoed. She frowned thoughtfully for a moment, then her face brightened and she smiled.
When I was young, she said, I learnt to play the drums.
The drums? Jenny nodded, and in proof of her assertion, agitated her knife and fork like a pair of drumsticks over her plate.
If there's any opportunity of playing the drums, she began.
But of course, said Anne, there's any amount of opportunity. We'll put you down definitely for the drums. That's the lot, she added.
And a very good lot, too, said Gombauld. I look forward to my bank holiday. It ought to be gay.
It ought indeed, Mr. Scogan assented. But you may rest assured that it won't be. No holiday is ever anything but a disappointment.
Come, come, protested Gombauld. My holiday at Crome isn't being a disappointment.
Isn't it? Anne turned an ingenuous mask towards him.
No, it isn't.
I'm delighted to hear it.
It's in the very nature of things, Mr. Scogan went on. Our holidays can't help being disappointments. Reflect for a moment. What is a holiday? The ideal, the platonic holiday of holidays, is surely a complete and absolute change. You agree with me in my definition?
Mr. Scogan glanced from face to face round the table. His sharp nose moved in a series of rapid jerks through all the points of the compass. There was no sign of dissent. He continued.
A complete and absolute change. Very well. But isn't a complete and absolute change precisely the thing we can never have, never in the very nature of things?
Mr. Scogan once more looked rapidly about him.
Of course it is. As ourselves, as specimens of Homo sapiens, as members of a society, how can we hope to have anything like an absolute change? We're tied down by the frightful limitation of our human faculties, by the notion which society imposes on us through our fatal suggestibility by our own personalities. For us, a complete holiday is out of the question. Some of us struggle manfully to take one, but we never succeed, if I may be allowed to express myself metaphorically, we never succeed in getting farther than Southend.
You're depressing, said Anne.
I mean to be, Mr. Scogan replied, and expanding the fingers of his right hand, he went on. Look at me, for example. What sort of a holiday can I take? In endowing me with passions and faculties, nature has been horribly niggardly. The full range of human potentialities is in any case distressingly limited. My range is a limitation within a limitation. Out of the 10 octaves that make up the human instrument, I can compass perhaps 2. Thus, while I may have a certain amount of intelligence, I have no aesthetic sense. While I possess the mathematical faculty, I am wholly without the religious emotions. While I am naturally addicted to venery, I have little ambition and am not at all avaricious. Education has further limited my scope. Having been brought up in society, I am impregnated with its laws. Not only should I be afraid of taking a holiday from them, I should also feel it painful to try to do so. In a word, I have a conscience as well as a fear of jail. Yes, I know it by experience. How often have I tried to take holidays to get away from myself, my own boring nature, my insufferable mental surroundings? Mr. Scogan sighed. But always without success. He added, always without success. In my youth, I was always striving, how hard, to feel religiously and aesthetically. Here, said I to myself, are two tremendously important and exciting emotions. Life would be richer, warmer, brighter, altogether more amusing if I could feel them. I tried to feel them. I read the works of the mystics. They seemed to me nothing but the most deplorable claptrap, as indeed they always must, to anyone who does not feel the same emotion as the authors felt when they were writing. For it is the emotion that matters. The written work is simply an attempt to express emotion, which is in itself inexpressible in terms of intellect and logic. The mystic objectifies a rich feeling in the pit of the stomach into a cosmology. For other mystics, that cosmology is a symbol of the rich feeling. For the unreligious, it is a symbol of nothing, and so appears merely grotesque. A melancholy fact. But I divagate. Mr. Scogan checked himself. So much for the religious emotion. As for the aesthetic, I was at even greater pains to cultivate that. I have looked at all the right works of art in every part of Europe. There was a time, I venture to believe, I knew more about Taddeo da Poggibonsi, more about the cryptic Amico di Taddeo, even than Henry does. Today, I am happy to say, I have forgotten most of the knowledge I then so laboriously acquired, but without vanity I can assert that it was prodigious. I don't pretend, of course, to know anything about nigger sculpture or the later 17th century in Italy, but about all the periods that were fashionable before 1900, I am, or was, omniscient. Yes, I repeat it, omniscient. But did that fact make me any more appreciative of art in general? It did not. Confronted by a picture of which I could tell you all the known and presumed history, the date when it was painted, the character of the painter, the influences that had gone to make it what it was, I felt none of that strange excitement and exaltation which is, as I am informed by those who do feel it, the true aesthetic emotion. I felt nothing but a certain interest in the subject of the picture, or more often, when the subject was hackneyed and religious, I felt nothing but a great weariness of spirit. Nevertheless, I must have gone on looking at pictures for 10 years before I would honestly admit to myself that they merely bored me. Since then, I have given up all attempts to take a holiday. I go on cultivating my old, stale, daily self in the resigned spirit with which a bank clerk performs from 10 till 6 his daily task. A holiday, indeed! I'm sorry for you, Gombauld, if you still look forward to having a holiday.
Gombauld shrugged his shoulders.
Perhaps, he said, my standards aren't as elevated as yours, but personally, I found the war quite as thorough a holiday from all the ordinary decencies and sanities, all the common emotions and preoccupations, as I ever want to have.
Yes, Mr. Scogan thoughtfully agreed.
Yes, the war was certainly something of a holiday. It was a step beyond Southend. It was Weston-super-Mare. It was almost Ilfracombe.
Chapter 26. A little canvas village of tents and booths had sprung up just beyond the boundaries of the garden, in the green expanse of the park. A crowd thronged its streets, the men dressed mostly in black, holiday best, funeral best, the women in pale muslins. Here and there, tricolour bunting hung inert. In the midst of the canvas town, scarlet and gold and crystal, the merry-go-round glittered in the sun. The balloon man walked among the crowd, and above his head, like a huge inverted bunch of many-coloured grapes, the balloon strained upwards. With a scythe-like motion, the boat swings reaped the air, and from the funnel of the engine which worked the roundabout rose a thin, scarcely wavering column of black smoke. Dennis had climbed to the top of one of Sir Ferdinando's towers, and there, standing on the sun-baked leads, his elbows resting on the parapet, he surveyed the scene. The steam organ sent up prodigious music. The clashing of automatic cymbals beat out with inexorable precision the rhythm of piercingly sounded melodies. The harmonies were like a musical shattering of glass and brass. Far down in the bass, the last trump was hugely blowing, and with such persistence, such resonance, that its alternate tonic and dominant detached themselves from the rest of the music and made a tune of their own, a loud, monotonous seesaw. Dennis leaned over the gulf of swirling noise. If he threw himself over the parapet, the noise would surely buoy him up, keep him suspended, bobbing as a fountain balances a ball on its breaking crest. Another fancy came to him, this time in metrical form. My soul is a thin white sheet of parchment stretched over a bubbling cauldron. Bad, bad. But he liked the idea of something thin and distended being blown up from underneath. My soul is a thin tent of gut, or better, my soul is a pale, tenuous membrane. That was pleasing. A thin, tenuous membrane. It had the right anatomical quality, tight-blown, quivering in the blast of noisy life. It was time for him to descend from the serene empyrean of words into the actual vortex. He went down slowly. My soul is a thin, tenuous membrane. On the terrace stood a knot of distinguished visitors. There was old Lord Malin, like a caricature of an English milord in a French comic paper, a long man with a long nose, and long drooping moustaches, and long teeth of old ivory, and lower down, absurdly, a short covert coat, and below that, long, long legs cased in pearl-grey trousers, legs that bent unsteadily at the knee, and gave a kind of sideways wobble as he walked. Beside him, short and thick-set, stood Mr. Calamay, the venerable conservative statesman with a face like a Roman bust and short white hair. Young girls didn't much like going for motor drives alone with Mr. Calamay, and of old Lord Malin one wondered why he wasn't living in gilded exile on the island of Capri, among the other distinguished persons who, for one reason or another, find it impossible to live in England. They were talking to Anne, laughing, the one profoundly, the other hootingly. A black silk balloon, towing a black-and-white striped parachute, proved to be old Mrs. Budge from the big house on the other side of the valley. She stood low on the ground, and the spikes of her black-and-white sunshade menaced the eyes of Priscilla Wimbush, who towered over her, a massive figure dressed in purple and topped with a queenly toque, on which the nodding black plumes recalled the splendours of a first-class Parisian funeral. Dennis peeped at them discreetly from the window of the morning room. His eyes were suddenly become innocent, childlike, unprejudiced. They seemed, these people, inconceivably fantastic. And yet they really existed. They functioned by themselves. They were conscious. They had minds. Moreover, he was like them. Could one believe it? But the evidence of the red notebook was conclusive. It would have been polite to go and say, "How do you do?" But at the moment, Dennis did not want to talk, could not have talked. His soul was a tenuous, tremulous, pale membrane. He would keep its sensibility intact and virgin as long as he could. Cautiously he crept out by a side door and made his way down towards the park. His soul fluttered as he approached the noise and movement of the fair. He paused for a moment on the brink, then stepped in and was engulfed. Hundreds of people, each with his own private face and all of them real, separate, alive. The thought was disquieting. He paid tuppence and saw the tattooed woman. Tuppence more, the largest rat in the world. From the home of the rat, he emerged just in time to see a hydrogen-filled balloon break loose for home. A child howled up over it, but calmly, a perfect sphere of flushed opal, it mounted, mounted. Dennis followed it with his eyes until it became lost on the blinding sunlight. If he could but send his soul to follow it. He sighed, stuck his steward's rosette in his buttonhole, and started to push his way aimlessly but officially through the crowd. Chapter 27. Mr. Scogan had been accommodated in a little canvas hut. Dressed in a black shirt and a red bodice, with a yellow and red bandana handkerchief tied round his black wig, he looked, sharp-nosed, brown and wrinkled, like the bohemian hag of Frith's Derby Day. A placard pinned to the curtain of the doorway announced the presence within the tent of Sesostris, the sorceress of Ecbatana. Seated at a table, Mr. Scogan received his clients in mysterious silence, indicating with a movement of the finger that they were to sit down opposite him and to extend their hands for his inspection. He then examined the palm that was presented him, using a magnifying glass and a pair of horn spectacles. He had a terrifying way of shaking his head, frowning and clicking with his tongue as he looked at the lines. Sometimes he would whisper as though to himself, "Terrible. Terrible," or "God preserve us," sketching out the sign of the cross as he uttered the words. The clients who came in laughing grew suddenly grave. They began to take the witch seriously. She was a formidable-looking woman. Could it be, was it possible, that there was something in this sort of thing after all? After all, they thought, as the hag shook her head over their hands, after all. And they waited with an uncomfortably beating heart for the oracle to speak. After a long and silent inspection, Mr. Scogan would suddenly look up and ask, in a hoarse whisper, some horrifying question, such as, "Have you ever been hit on the head with a hammer by a young man with red hair?" When the answer was in the negative, which it could hardly fail to be, Mr. Scogan would nod several times, saying, "I was afraid so. Everything is still to come. Still to come, though it can't be very far off now." Sometimes, after a long examination, he would just whisper, "Where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise," and refuse to divulge any details of a future too appalling to be envisaged without despair. Sesostris had a success of horror. People stood in a queue outside the witch's booth, waiting for the privilege of hearing sentence pronounced upon them. Dennis, in the course of his round, looked with curiosity at this crowd of suppliants before the shrine of the oracle. He had a great desire to see how Mr. Scogan played his part. The canvas booth was a rickety, ill-made structure. Between its walls and its sagging roof were long, gaping chinks and crannies. Dennis went to the tea-tent and borrowed a wooden bench and a small union jack. With these, he hurried back to the booth of Sesostris. Setting down the bench at the back of the booth, he climbed up and, with a great air of busy efficiency, began to tie the union jack to the top of one of the tent poles. Through the crannies in the canvas, he could see almost the whole of the interior of the tent. Mr. Scogan's bandana-covered head was just below him. His terrifying whispers came clearly up. Dennis looked and listened while the witch prophesied financial losses, death by apoplexy, destruction by air raids in the next war. "Is there going to be another war?" asked the old lady to whom he had predicted this end. "Very soon," said Mr. Scogan with an air of quiet confidence. The old lady was succeeded by a girl dressed in white muslin, garnished with pink ribbons. She was wearing a broad hat, so that Dennis could not see her face, but from her figure and the roundness of her bare arms, he judged her young and pleasing. Mr. Scogan looked at her hand, then whispered,
"You are still virtuous."
The young lady giggled and exclaimed, "Oh, Lord!"
"But you will not remain so for long," added Mr. Scogan sepulchrally.
The young lady giggled again.
"Destiny, which interests itself in small things no less than in great, has announced the fact upon your hand."
Mr. Scogan took up the magnifying glass and began once more to examine the white palm.
"Very interesting," he said, as though to himself. "Very interesting. It's as clear as day."
He was silent. "What's clear?" asked the girl.
"I don't think I ought to tell you."
Mr. Scogan shook his head. The pendulous brass earrings which he had screwed onto his ears tinkled. "Please, please," she implored. The witch seemed to ignore her remark.
"Afterwards, it's not at all clear. The fates don't say whether you will settle down to married life and have 4 children, or whether you will try to go on the cinema and have none. They're only specific about this one rather crucial incident."
"What is it? What is it? Oh, do tell me."
The white muslin figure leant eagerly forward. Mr. Scogan sighed.
"Very well," he said. "If you must know, you must know. But if anything untoward happens, you must blame your own curiosity. Listen, listen."
He lifted up a sharp claw-nailed forefinger.
"This is what the fates have written. Next Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock, you will be sitting on the second stile on the footpath that leads from the church to the lower road. At that moment, a man will appear walking along the footpath."
Mr. Scogan looked at her hand again, as though to refresh his memory of the details of the scene.
"A man," he repeated, "a small man with a sharp nose, not exactly good-looking, nor precisely young, but fascinating."
He lingered hissingly over the word.
"He will ask you, 'Can you tell me the way to paradise?' And you will answer, 'Yes, I'll show you,' and walk with him down towards the little hazel copse. I cannot read what will happen after that."
There was a silence. "Is it really true?" asked White Muslin. The witch gave a shrug of the shoulders.
"I merely tell you what I read in your hand. Good afternoon. That will be 6 pence. Yes, I have changed. Thank you. Good afternoon."
End of side 11.